when times in our lives seem confusing and your world appears to be just a little too crazy. Go ahead and take a rest here. Laugh, learn, enjoy a little bit from the lives of others with author and business coach Dennis Mansfield. Then share it with others because joy is just around the corner.
A friend of mine recently said, "The only stuff that happens, happens along the way. So get going." I would add, let's get going because the world is just around the corner. Hi, this is Dennis Mansfield, and welcome to the podcast. History has a unique way of judging itself. And for the purpose of today, I'd like to just challenge you about the things that we think are real may in fact not be real and maybe never happen like we thought. For example, the absolute picture of the Wild West from 1860s on showed the gunfighter. One of the most famous gunfighters of all time was Wild Bill Hickok. A lot of people don't realize that was not his name. His name was James Butler Hickok, and he was a young man when he decided that crime would pay better. So he changed his name to his father's name, Bill. And the wildness came because of what he did. You see, by the summer of 1861, right when the Civil War was in force, Hickok was working really as just a small role in a stage depot in Nebraska, and a guy came and picked on him. This is where it started. A mean-spirited man, a guy named David McCandless, and he picked on him, and he picked on him, and he called him names. And finally, in 1861, Hickok and McCandless came to a head in their anger. You see, it was at this point that this young boy, if you will, Bill Hickok, made the decision that if he was picked on again, he would pull out his handgun and blow the son of a gun away. McCandless did it, and so did Wild Bill Hickok. He killed this man, shot him in the chest, and blew him out of the particular saloon that they were in. So when you think about it, the picture of violent men that we have in our culture for today stems from Western shootouts and saloons, which really didn't happen that often. In fact, it wasn't until 4 years later that Wild Bill Hickok fought his first real Western showdown. It's what many really consider the first true Western showdown in a street. He shot another Dave, a guy named Dave Tutt. He shot him dead in the market square in Springfield, Missouri. You know, Hollywood movies show it as one at one end of the street and one at the other end. And you think, oh, that's how it was. It actually wasn't that way until this particular day in a cold November. And as it occurred, they were at one end of the street. They got together. They realized, okay, this is how we're going to settle it, with a duel. And in the process of those few minutes, Bill Hickok killed the man at the other end of the street, Dave Tutt. And it became food, really, for people to talk about. It didn't happen that often. And in Bill Hickok's life, it didn't happen again. His fights were all done in saloons or whatever, but they weren't that often. And it wasn't until a few years later, when he himself was in a saloon, that someone came up behind him and shot him to death. You see, 20 years later, Billy the Kid came into our lexicon of history. And all of the cowboy shows of the criminals from then till now have all been framed through the idea of the viciousness of Billy the Kid. These were some vicious men, there's no doubt about it, but it wasn't the Wild West that everybody speaks of. And Billy the Kid is good proof of that. He wasn't really on the scene for very long. He only was there a few years. And it took to the point of a posse coming after him with Pat Garrett in charge of that posse. And what they did was they found out where he lived. They went after him. And then Pat Garrett, knowing that Billy the Kid was as ruthless as he was, actually hid in Billy the Kid's room in the shadows so that when the kid came through, Garrett gunned him down. You see, there was no noble knights of the day They were just vicious men who had to be treated as criminals. And it's very interesting thing to note that even as America continues on with how to handle criminals, it was just recently announced that the federal government would now start again the death penalty. Well, you know, whether you're Republican or Democrat, whether you're conservative or liberal, the reality is that in those days, in the 1860s, the 1880s, there was a death penalty. And that happened as a result of the Pat Garretts and the others who came. Now, freedom versus responsibility. You see, they had the freedom to live whichever way they wanted to live in those days, cowboy days, just as we do. But the issue of responsibility became, what do I owe to my fellow man? It was really a question of liberty versus licentiousness. Just because I want that, I take that, the answer to that is no. And so from the Civil War, this time of violence and unbelievable carnage, came this idea of government, but first, self-government. You see, they knew, the men in the gray and the men in the blue, knew that they had to stand ready and then to do what they needed to do in a battle based on self-government, a following and submitting to their commanders, their captains, their brigade commanders. And it was in that case that the America of the 1860s became fully aware of the fact that self-government was absolutely vital before we had government. Recently, I was in Savannah, Georgia, and I had the opportunity to look at the Southern culture of both the Revolutionary time as well as the Civil War time. And it was fascinating to see the culture of looking at war and believing that God was on our side, both North and South. And Abe Lincoln said it well, and I think it is second or third year of presidency. He said, that's not the question. The question is whether we're on God's side. In other words, the reality is, are we following him? Are we looking at the Creator? Are we doing that? And it's not a matter of God on our side. It's a matter of, are we on God's side? And in Savannah, Georgia, I was, you look around and you see history and it unfolds and there's decades and there's, and suddenly one time, as I was walking through the many, many squares that they have, it's a beautiful layout, I came to a spot that looked oddly familiar. And I looked over and it was the area where they filmed Forrest Gump, right on the bench, right there in front of the world. And it was the Savannah culture that still acknowledges that there was something valuable in the antebellum time, there was something better in the post-Civil War time, and that the culture and the softness and the kindness that the Forrest Gump film showed about one Southern boy continued to encourage us to today. One of the things that was fascinating for me, when I look at culture, I have to look at food. I have to look at, what are people eating? What are they enjoying? And we took a food tour all through the history of Savannah. My heavens, it was like a progressive dinner. If you don't know what that is, you can take it from me. They're fun. You start at one person's restaurant or house, and then you have an appetizer. You move to the next, then you have the salad or the soup. Then you move to the next, and you have appetizer, and then you move to the next. We did this all over downtown Savannah. By the way, go to Savannah. What a great city. What an incredible place to be. And we loved it. We found history. We found the tour of the squares, what it was down there. We found out more things about both the South of the 1776 era and, of course, the South of the Civil War time. And then finally, we just went to the area right adjacent to the ocean shoreline of where the story of glory happened. Not familiar with the story of Glory? It's an amazing motion picture done in 1989. The 30th anniversary of it was just recent. And I'll be speaking later on in the podcast episode today about that. I hope you enjoy it. Just know this, that history has a unique way of judging itself. As time goes by, clarity shows itself. The next generation that has self-government can understand how they can use it for the purpose of better government, better times, and joyful living.
If you ever plan to motor west, travel my way Take the highway, that's the best. Get your kicks on Route 66.
Now, Ken, you and I have been traveling all over, and it's not unusual for us to visit a sign. We'll see the brown sign. We'll get off the freeway or the highway, and we'll go and see it. And then we get back on the road, and then we've got a long stretch to our next one, but not always.
This particular time, we just got done visiting and learning about John Wayne or Marion Morrison, Marion Michael Morrison's birthplace. And we're back on the road. We just crossed from Iowa to Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And there in Tampico, Illinois, is a sign, a brown sign, birthplace of President Ronald Reagan.
We were blown away. We're like, what? The Duke and President Reagan all within miles of each other? Oh, my heavens. Those are some tough placentas. What happened then?
So when we pulled off, we followed the signs, and it was great because their little village of Tampico, Illinois, one of the major stores has this huge mural of everything Ronald Reagan, from his movie days to his governor days to his presidential days.
In Tampico.
Tampico.
I didn't even know where that, I thought that was in Mexico, you know?
El Tampico.
Yeah, and what we're there, and we're looking at this wall and the all of the celebratory things of Ronald Reagan.
And we follow the signs to see the actual house. We pull up, and what, do you remember what vehicle was sitting out?
Well, let's put it this way. Let's take our listeners back to Christmas vacation with Chevy Chase and his wife, and their uncle or their cousin Eddie is out in front with the RV, and he's dislodging the sludge into the trash cans, and immediately, I think both of our minds went,
Cousin Eddie's here.
Cousin Eddie's here in front of Ronald Reagan's birth house. And I'm like, what the heck?
I was totally blown away because the sign itself was obviously a handmade sign. Oh, it was a for sale
Ronald
sign.
Ronald Reagan, their town.
With like Unabomber letters all over it. It's the birthplace of Ronald Reagan.
I don't want anyone to know who did this. You know, FBI is investigating. They still haven't found.
And we for about 5 seconds, we thought, hey, would it be cool if we walked up and knocked on the door and said, can we take a tour?
Yeah.
But we saw children's playground stuff, balls and bicycles in
people
the yard.
Were people living there. In this home. Crazy. And it was pretty run down.
Oh, it was bad.
Oh, my heavens. And we looked at the sign. We looked at the RV. We looked at each other. And we went,
no, thanks.
Yeah, this is about close enough we want to do. Well, you know, we could be pretty adventurous going into places. But it was like, we could have gone to the house next door and had the same effect. Hey, can we come into your house? Get the heck out of here. As you hear the shotgun going, you know? No. We valued our life.
Absolutely. And so when we spun around and took off down the street, we decided to go ahead and enjoy the village of Tampico.
Yes.
Unfortunately, it was a Sunday. I think it was a Sunday afternoon.
Yeah, it was.
And everything was closed up. So we were able to just remember how Ronald Reagan was had been an effect in our lives in different ways. I served in the Army from 85 through 90,
mm-hmm.
and served under Ronald Reagan in 85 through 87. And I actually have a unique award, as well as my brothers from the 164th Military Police Company, that we have a presidential unit citation given to us for doing some very top secret stuff in mm-hmm. what was called West Germany back then. Now it's just Germany. But that's kind of a unique award.
And Reagan gave it to you.
Ronald Reagan gave it to our unit.
Yeah.
And so we all get to
wear it. It's an amazing time. So I remember walking with you, having you tell me that story. And then, you know, for me, because I had been in the Army for 2 years in the 70s when Ronald Reagan was still governor of California, and the idea of him running for president was laughable by many people, not by those of us who either had contact with him or knew about him for what his goals were. But there we were. And so I'm thinking to myself, in the 70s, this guy's going to do something. When he lost in 1976 in the convention, it was a very fascinating thing because the sitting vice president, or sitting president, who had been an appointed vice president, Gerald Ford, became president when Richard Nixon resigned. Now he was running for president, and Ronald Reagan was running against him. In Nancy Reagan's book, My Turn. She spends more chapters on the Ford-Reagan race and all the things that were done to her hubby, Ronnie, than she did in the winning of the race in 1980. And so you can see that in the 70s, there was all this agitation. Reagan could never be anything. He could not be. And suddenly, in 80, they said, yes, he can. And from 80 on, he was accepted and respected.
Absolutely.
And it was pretty amazing. So for us to be able to see Cousin Eddie's RV parked out in front of Ronald Reagan's house, birth house, we were both kind of like, yeah, this one doesn't fit.
From meager beginning.
Yeah. You want a cold one? Here, have mine. It's like, what? So if you're in Tampico, and you don't have to speak Spanish because it's Illinois, but you do have to speak Illinois. And if you're in Chicago, you have to speak like this, but you're not quite, because I think there's a distance from Tampico to Chicago.
There was.
Yeah, we had a little bit of a ride after we were done. We did enjoy it. Yes. And it was one of those moments in time where we thought, wow, Brown Sign Brothers, together we discovered something for us that has continued to be a fun source of laughter and stories, obviously, that we're now sharing with you. Just a few days ago, I had the honor of being invited in to see the 30th anniversary of the film Glory. It's a 1989 film that really has captured people's hearts for years. It didn't really win a lot of, people with money at the time who went in the theater, but it did capture the hearts of Americans who love history, who love the history of the military, and who love the history of the military as it pertains to African-Americans. And so Denzel Washington won his first Academy Award in that film. The film is a remarkable tale that was directed by Edward Zwick. And it's an interesting point. Zwick never had done a film before this. He had done television. He had done other things. But they came to him and said, does this idea of the 54th Massachusetts Infantry Regiment really mean something to you about how they were the second African-American regiment in the American Civil War? And as he listened to it and heard about it, he said, yeah. So he began the process of getting Matthew Broderick, who played Colonel Robert Goldshaw. He got Morgan Freeman. He got Cary Elwes, who you may remember from Princess Bride. He put together a crew of people, and at that time, it was kind of interesting because Denzel Washington was an acknowledged fine actor, but had not been a star. And so 1989, he's shown at that point. The story itself is a remarkable story of freedmen. Now, today's life and times, we don't think about freedmen. What does that mean? Well, there were slaves, and there were men and women who were freed, hence the freedmen idea. And the freedmen were in the North, in Massachusetts. There were a number of abolitionist sympathizers who asked for and received the African-American culture that were freed men. They were not slaves. They had their own businesses. They worked for people. They were not slaves. And yet, the Union Army would not allow them to fight until the point in 1862 and then 1863, when the white soldiers were not coming in and volunteering and the draft was starting and there were riots in New York City that white soldiers didn't want to fight. Well, the 54th Massachusetts Infantry Regiment said, we're in, and they started the process. The film talks about that, and it's fascinating as a piece to watch, an entertainment piece. It's fantastic. There's a scene in it, and for me as a Christian, I was stunned by the openness of and the acceptance of the black community towards the love of Christ that was in it. There were others that didn't believe, but on the edge, on the eve of a serious battle, you could hear the music start. You could hear the black church revival. You could see the soldiers swaying. It was a remarkable act of cinematography when they captured Morgan Freeman singing and Denzel Washington singing and so many of the other top flight actors that were a part of it. And then it goes on to what happened with the 54th. Now, I'm not going to go there because I want you to go there. I want you to see with your own eyes. I want you to hear with your own ears. I want you to feel with your heart what I felt just a few nights ago after 30 years of thinking about it, because I had seen the film Glory in the theater back in 1989. And when they had this incredible opportunity to see it in the bigness of a huge theater, about the bigness of a huge story, I said, I've got to go. And so my bride Susan and I went. I don't know if the term enjoy is right, but we appreciated it. And I believe that as you have the opportunity to get it on Netflix or Prime, get it, watch it. It is the tale of glory, the glory of men who are soldiers, the glory of a nation that fought for a just cause, and the glory of God that loved them. Part of each episode of Just Around the Corner is really dedicated to oddities. All right, here's the deal. I don't want a freak show. I don't want a carnival atmosphere. That much, at least. But there are some times when things pop out and you go, what? Well, of course, today's show has started with the whole issue of the Civil War, went through the viciousness of people living and dying. And how do you take odd and funny stories? Well, I don't know if it's funny, but here's a story that happened in 1853. California Rangers, much like Texas Rangers, were out and about making sure that all the desperados were taken care of. There was a guy named Joaquin Murrieta. Joaquin Murrieta was a very vicious man. And the entire state of California said, bring him in dead or alive. So in the process of a number of California Rangers, they were scared to death, and they were led by Los Angeles deputy sheriff, whose name was Harry Love. I just love it. The guy's name is Harry Love, okay? And he goes out, and they find Murrieta, and they use his brother-in-law to take him to where Murrieta is, and then they just shoot him. They just shoot him dead. I mean, again, you know, the idea of, I guess it was a bit of justice, to them at least. And then they had this problem. They were like, well, now he's dead. Now we got to cart his body all the way back. So Harry Love decided, nah, I got a better idea. Let's decapitate him. They took his head off. They poured all their brandy into a big bucket, and they put the head in so that the liquor would take care of making sure Joaquin Murrieta's head would not rot before the proper time. Oh, my heavens. I saw that and I went, this is America. Oddity number two. What about Black Bart? 1870s? Oh, what a criminal. Robbing Wells Fargo. He went about the process of not just taking the money, but he left poems. Here I lay me down to sleep, to wait the coming morrow, perhaps success, perhaps defeat, and everlasting sorrow. Yet come what will, I'll try it once. My conditions can't be worse. And if there's money in that box, 'tis money in my purse. A gentleman. In fact, every time he robbed somebody, he was an amazing gentleman. Well, people began to talk about Black Bart. He wasn't so nefarious. But turned out the reason why is that when they finally found out who this guy was, they tracked him down through a series of things, a handkerchief and some other things, through a laundry, and they found out that he was Charles Bolton, an elderly man from San Francisco. He's an old dude who quotes poetry and steals people, sticks them up, you know, at the Wells Fargo stagecoach. And he confessed to being Black Bart, but bitterly disputed the fact that his reputation was as an outlaw. I am a gentleman, he said. All right. So odd facts. Yes. Here's another one. 1903. Who was the first person to buy a Ford Motor Company car? Who was it? Anybody know? It's odd. His name is Ernest Pfennig. Pfennig, P-F-E-N-N-I-N-G, which is the German word for penny. Ernst Pfennig. He bought an $850 two-cylinder Model A automobile. He was the first one to buy it off of the Mack Street assembly line in Detroit, and it was delivered to him just a week later. Henry Ford built his vehicles, built millions of vehicles. Ah, but there was only one first, and it went to this particular gentleman, Ernst Pfennig, in 1903. Henry Ford continued with his wealth to do things that were kind of interesting. He became a follower of Mahatma Gandhi. He loved what Gandhi was saying about pacification and all of pacifism and all of the different ideas of peace in whatever way he could. And so he wrote a letter in 1941, 38 years after he sold his first car to Ernst Pfennig. And he just absolutely poured out his support for Gandhi. And it was really effusive in his praise. And as a result of that, Gandhi ended up sending to him this huge spinning wheel. I mean, it went like 8,000 miles across the world. One guy had to carry it. He was like a Sherpa or something. I don't know. But the reality was he brought it back and gave it to Henry Ford. Ford didn't even know what it was or what to do with it. But it had Gandhi's autograph on it. And it was, you know, kind of like from Mahatma to Henry. And he loved it. You can actually see it nowadays if you have the opportunity to be in Michigan and go to Greenfield Village. Odd points in history. Well, if we're talking about Henry Ford, we're talking about cars. And guess what? 1920, the three-point seatbelt inventor, Nils, N-I-L-S, Bolin, was born. He was a Swedish engineer in 1920, grew up all through Sweden, saw cars come and go, and then up to 1959, when he was 39 years old, there had only been two-point seatbelts. For those of you who follow old cars, you know what I mean? It goes across your lap. But he came up and said, what would happen if we had shoulder, lap, and connection? And in that particular year, in 1959, he developed it. Ford and General Motors and everybody else were slow to come to it. But once they did, they realized that because Volvo did it, it was safe, because other companies that this particular individual, Nils Bolin, talked into it, that over the history of cars, that over 11,000 lives each year are saved because of this one man whose name we never knew, but whose belt we always buckle. Strange and odd truths, things of interest. Hope you like that. Just Around the Corner is a feature of DennisMansfield.com. Original music and podcast production by Michael Seals. Kudos to the Traveling Wilburys, Nat King Cole, Ken and Colin Mansfield, Ryan Yeager, Jerry Woods, and Kevin Miller in the Morning for your inspiration.